KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we talk baseball as the season begins and America's national pastime engenders the usual excitement in those enthralled with the game. Even if you're indifferent to the prospects of the two home teams, there are ongoing issues such as steroid use, players' salaries, and the joy of the game and what it brings to millions of people both here and abroad. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. The National Basketball Championship may have been determined last night with the University of Florida defeating Ohio State, but with that game concluding the NCAA rounds, the baseball season also began. The Oakland A's lost their season opener 4-0 to the Seattle Mariners, and opening day for the San Francisco Giants at China Basin is today against the San Diego Padres. We want in this hour to survey how things look for the home teams and for the national pastime, but also to have a look at the game, at the boys of summer, and at the seeming endless appeal of a game which is now more global than ever. So we've got a couple of baseball historians, professors with us, but we also have Larry Baer, who we're going to talk to first of all, who's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer with the San Francisco Giants at Pac Bell. Welcome, Larry Baer.
Hi, Michael. How are you? It's my favorite day of the year, I have to say, and that's not an exaggeration. Opening day is, there's just something about it. It doesn't exist in the other sports, as I think your guests would agree, and hopefully you agree with. It's just a day that's, you sort of suspend all of your cares and, you know, kind of come out to the ballpark.
It's an inimitable day, but maybe it might compare, for example, to the last day of the season if you were going to the championship?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It's but that you can't plan for. Opening day, you can plan to have an opening day, and I think there might be in this town a few dentist appointments, you know, and people have a stub their toenail and couldn't make it into work today.
I want to get a sense from you how the season looks to you. A lot of the prognosticators are just kind of taking stock of where they're plotting the Giants and seem to be putting him in third place for this year, quite to the contrary to the way you see things, I imagine.
Well, you know, Michael, it's a little bit of shades of the late 90s when Dusty Baker, some of his teams, where a lot of last place forecasts, you know, some middle of the pack forecasts, as you say, third place. And I honestly believe that if you look at the National League, and maybe you take out a team or two, like perhaps the Washington Nationals, because they're in a rebuilding mode, maybe Pittsburgh. But if you look at the National League, there are a dozen teams or so, 13, 14 teams, that truly could go to the playoffs. And that's, you know, that's a function of the P word, which some people think is a good thing, others don't, but parity. And and I think that, quite frankly, just look at our division, the five teams in our division. Anybody tells you that there's a clear-cut, you know, team that's, you know, head and shoulders above anybody else, you know, it would be at the Dodgers, Padres, Rockies, or Diamondbacks, or Giants, I think that just is not true. I mean, I think that all five teams have you know, some holes, that we all have strengths, and it's going to be a pretty close race, or, you know, it's going to depend on how everybody obviously executes, but health and everything else, I think you can't forecast much in our division this year.
What can you forecast that's different under the new management of Bruce Bochy?
You know, what's interesting about Bruce is he's a very, very understated guy when it comes to his own persona. He wants to let the players have all the attention. So some of the due diligence we did when, you know, Brian Sabian, who ultimately needs to make the final recommendation on Bruce Bochy or on the field manager, some of the due diligence that was done leading up to that, you talk to veteran players, they love Boch. Why? Because he lets them do their thing. He cares a lot. He's a great communicator. than the young players. So sometimes guys that, you know, are good with veterans may not be great with the young players. The young players, you know, guys of the Padres, guys like Gonzalez, Khalil Green, Boch is great. He's, you know, he's a good teacher. He, he sets down rules and he's fair. So the thing with him is I think he's going to be very good with the players, and he's going to also understand pitchers in a way that perhaps we haven't had here, you know, in a while, because he was a former catcher, is a former catcher. I have a theory that, Michael, that perhaps former catchers, that's the best position to prepare somebody to manage for. And you know, look, Dusty was a wonderful manager, Felipe as well. But, you look at some other great managers, the Joe Torres of the world and Bob Brenly, et cetera, they were catchers.
And I didn't mean to mangle his name. I wanted to make him into another sport that's famous in San Francisco. It's bocce rather than bochi.
You see that on the back of buses. Bochi ball.
Bochi ball, yeah. And he's going to be facing his former team today.
I think it's going to be there's going to be a lot of emotion for Bruce because he was in that organization 25 years as a player, a coach, and a manager. And you know, there's going to be a lot of storylines and themes, I think, Michael, today. Barry Zito making his first start on this side of the bay.
I thought you were going to say making $126 million.
Well, that too. And I'll tell you, he's a guy, though, that if there was ever somebody that could make you forget about that aspect of his off season and the signature signing and everything, the money, he's the guy. He's a guy that could do it. Just a couple of quick anecdotes. Once he was signed, he took it upon himself to call every other pitcher in the organization, you know, in the major league roster, and say, "Hey, I'm here. I want to hang with you guys. We're all in this together. When can we meet?" That's one thing he did right upon signing, just to basically say, "I'm not here to big time anybody, and I'm just one of the guys." Then, just as we were breaking camp, he went over to the minor league complex, about 200 players who would not be making it with the big club north to San Francisco, and he took them all out. He took over a restaurant, took them all out to dinner, and worked the crowd, and basically, you know, said, "Hey, good luck in Norwich, good luck in Fresno, you know, want to see you up here before long." That's the kind of effort he has made to make himself fit in, as opposed to be, you know, just a guy that's trying to be exalted, you know, an exalted state over his fellow teammates.
Speaking of exalted states, of course, everybody's going to be watching Barry Bonds as he chases Hank Aaron's record. And I happen to notice, perhaps you did as well, a review that Jim Bouton did in the New York Times Sunday supplement. And he was talking about these records really having no validity because of the whole steroids mess. What's your take on that?
Well, that is going to be a question that I think, Michael, quite frankly, will be debated for not this year, not, you know, months after this year. I think it'll be for years, maybe decades. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody really knows how to handle all this. On the one hand, you have people, I heard Matt Williams saying the other day, you know, to hit a baseball, it takes skill that, you know, quote-unquote drugs can't impact. Now, this is a former player, a former home run hitter saying that. The truth is we can't have performance-enhancing drugs in the sport. We know that they've been in the sport. We don't know individually which players, other than positive drug tests, and Barry Bonds doesn't have one, which players have been using, which players haven't been using. In the end of the day, you know, there's going to be an era that will have to be reviewed. I think it's very difficult to, adjust everything right now and say that, you know, years, you know, 1999 to 2003 don't count or don't, you know, or need to be treated differently. That's tough to do. But, it's a problem that that's been a big problem for the industry. But I think we're the good news is we're coming out the other end because we have a good drug testing policy. It's not perfect and needs to be improved further if that's possible, such as tests for human growth hormone and But that's right now, that's just a blood test, and that's a tough thing to administer, you know, on a regular basis in a clubhouse.
Well, on the positive side, we're looking forward to an exciting season. And, Larry, always good to talk to you. Appreciate your being with us. Larry Berrigan is Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the San Francisco Giants.
We will see you at the ballpark, and this is going to be a fun year with the All-Star Game and with all the themes and home run record chases and Barry Zito and the Yankees coming to town. Michael, this is not going to be a dull year.
Well, okay, we got your guarantee on that.
Okay.
Thanks, Larry.
See you soon. Thanks a lot.
Good to talk to you. We're also talking this hour with, our resident baseball historian, Eric Solomon, baseball writer and English professor, who has taught a course on the history and literature of baseball. He joins us in studio. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Michael.
And Bill Gould is with us, who is also a professor, emeritus law professor at Stanford, teaches and has taught many years labor and sports law at Stanford, and is in the process actually of writing a book about how the game has changed since World War II, and he joins us from down Stanford way. Good morning, Bill Gould.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you with us, and I want to get some, we used to do this with Len Coppett, of course, get some assessment from our two academics here who have studied the game assiduously through the years. But first I have to go on record as saying that we talked to Larry Berry. We wanted to talk to somebody from the A's organization. Nobody was available to us. I find that baffling. I just have to say that for the record, because we went after them and there was simply no one available. Used to be in the old days during the Haas organization that they'd be here in a New York instant, as Roy Eisenhardt, I think, put it. Bill Gould, by the way, you want to speculate on that? Is this a different administration under Lou Wolfe, or has something changed that we should know about?
Well, I don't know whether, in terms of public relations, whether this is a different administration. Obviously, the Haas family, Roy Eisenhardt, were very outgoing, community-involved people. They really changed the way in which the Oakland A's operated. I think that the Oakland A's have been the subject of a good deal of interest, particularly because of this book, Moneyball, which I think really got a very, I don't want to say distorted, but a limited view of the way in which they assess players.
Should mention that's Billy Beane's book, yeah.
Yes.
About Billy Beane.
It's about Billy Beane, yeah. In particular, by a fellow named Michael Lewis,
right,
as I recollect it. And he presented a picture which outlined the A's as relying to an extent to which it hadn't been done previously upon statistics, on-base percentage, which is as old as the game itself. My sense is that the A's continue to use scouts who look at players, who observe people, who make really good judgments. The A's make very good judgments about player personnel, and it may be that they are a little reluctant to get into a discussion about the way in which they make these kinds of judgments.
Well, as one producer Kevin said, it wasn't like we were asking them to give a deposition, but this will have to remain one for the books. We'll go to Eric Solomon here, who is our fearless prognosticator. How's it look for the two home teams from your perspective?
Seen through a glass darkly. One of the reasons the A's didn't appear, Michael, they are on the road,
there are people in the front office here, though.
Oh, no, everybody goes because they all want to see how Billy Beane's predictions come out. You know, that book,
we do
by
have a telephone
way,
as an instrument, of course, to communicate as well. You understand?
Yeah. The Michael Lewis book saddened many of us who love to think that Billy Beane was on to something, because we were promised in that book that a catcher named Jeremy Brown was the epitome of everything that Beane thought of. He had all the tools that they were searching for on the A's. And year after year, it's been 5 years now, he goes to spring training, and he's either too heavy or he's not quite ready yet, and down he goes again. And so when you do get in touch with the A's, tell us that there's a Jeremy Brown fan club growing in the Bay Area. The A's are picked in the New York Times, you know, to win their division. They need some luck, but they do have a lot of young players, and the Giants have them somewhere, but they're in Fresno or Point South or West. I love the Giants because as we age, and Bill will agree with this, we tend to identify with the older ball players coming down the end of the line, one of the oldest second basemen still playing regularly, one of the oldest shortstop still playing regularly, one of the oldest left field, etc. It's a really nice team for the retired to come out and watch. They got some young pitchers, but this is going to be an interesting geriatric season. I wish them the very best because they're my kind of people.
Eric Solomon, again, is baseball writer and English professor at San Francisco State. And Bill Gould also writes about baseball. He's emeritus law professor at Stanford. Bill, I don't know if you saw the column in the New York Times, the editorial in the New York Times by Bradbury, all about how steroids and all these other things can't be blamed for the way the game has changed. What he blamed it on was the expansion going back to the 90s and said the game has been so diluted since then that that's been responsible for all these changes in records.
Well, I did see the piece, Michael, and as is so often the case, I agree with part of his thesis, but don't agree with other aspects of it. I mean, I think that expansion these past four and a half decades, bringing us to 30 clubs rather than 16 clubs, has had a diluting effect and increased the disparity perhaps between the very good and the very bad. But there is an assumption, and it was interesting to hear Larry Baer talk about this in his article, that steroids have been eliminated from the game. And I find that quite a remarkable assumption. You may have seen there was another piece in the Sunday New York Times really analyzing the way in which the drug testing program in baseball is operating and highlighting, I think, three critical deficiencies in it. One is the infrequency of off-season testing. Second is the rather flexible and loose way in which players are monitored or chaperoned, as they say, after they're told that they're going to have a test on a particular given day. And the third is, and this is a problem with all sports, that at the end of the day, there is no independent authority in baseball verifying how the tests are administered, what the outcome of the test is. And baseball created a very difficult problem for itself in the 90s because, of course, both parties, the players and the owners, were financially interested in the way in which the game boomed, the fact that Brady Anderson, who played very briefly for the Boston Red Sox in the 80s, never known as a home run hitter, could suddenly blast 50 home runs out of the park. And there were other examples of this that made people kind of raise their eyebrows and say to themselves, is there something else involved here? Baseball enjoyed a great deal of financial success in the wake of the 94-95 strike. I think it is generally thought because of the use of steroids by players. I don't think that we've seen necessarily an end to this process. Larry Baer mentioned the fact that human growth is not being tested, and now there's a flap about Gary Matthews, who plays for the Angels, and whether or not he took human growth drugs. So the verdict is very much out on this. I think steroids have played a role. Expansion has played a role. Some people talk about the ball. You know, it's clear that pitchers as well as hitters, many of them look very different today. And this may be attributable to a number of factors, but this is, I think, an ongoing problem.
Eric Solomon, you heard the law professor say the verdict's out. You agree?
Not really. I think that obviously players have been, in every sport, have been using drugs for as long as drugs have been available. And the greenies and the reds that used to be around, the amphetamines in every clubhouse, even in every high school locker room, is part of the history. And as the drugs get more sophisticated, so do the players. I'm not particularly worried about the question of records. I am always worried about the message it gives to young people and the logic that drugs will not do permanent harm to anyone, I think, is really fairly casual. Brady Anderson, by the way, did move from the Red Sox and hit all those home runs in the Baltimore park, most of them. But that was startling to everyone when it happened, because he was a very light hitter, and suddenly, boom.
Well, one thing I think maybe, Bill Gould, you might agree with Larry Bear on is the kind of magic that associates itself with opening day.
Oh, I do. And, Michael, just let me mention one other thing that could be associated with these records, and that is, of course, the change in stadiums, the fact that, as well as expansion and drugs, we have stadiums in which it's easier to hit home runs these days, and I'm sure that is a factor along with these others. Yes, I'm always very excited about opening day. It's a very special day. You have kind of a bounce in your step. Hope springs eternal. This is the way I feel. I'm excited about looking at the Giants this afternoon out at, as I continue to call it, Pac Bell, a very lovely, lovely stadium that isn't quite as home run conducive.
Excuse me a second, Bill, because I think Eric had perhaps some disagreement on that notion that the stadiums play a significant role here.
Well, stadiums always have. The wall in Fenway Park was either a temptation or a open the sluices for some batters. Mel Ott made a career by hitting 250 foot home runs into that right field in the Polo Grounds, and they've been variations, but certainly I think the main change in parks was getting them up a mile. They call it Mile High Stadium, and lightening the air. That did make a
The most of the new stadiums following the Camden Yards ballpark in 1992, which really pioneered the way, are more hitter friendly. It's unusual for the new stadiums. Safeco is one of them. Pac Bell is sort of in between. San Diego is one of them. It's unusual for them to constitute the kind of exception that Safeco does. These parks are, it is admitted by players present and past that these stadiums are more home run friendly. And of course, this is part of the general trend beginning, I think, really with 1968 when Yastrzemski won the batting average with an average of 301, the lowest since 1945, that made baseball lower the mound and then ultimately move away from these concrete jungles that had been part of the 1970s and 80s.
Bill Gould, forgive me, but we're coming up on a break here, and I want to get our listeners involved in this discussion. Opening day, what does it mean to you? Also, what about the game? It's mystique. Some prospects perhaps from some of you about the home teams. Our phone lines are open and available to you. It's a toll-free number from wherever you're listening to us or however, radio, internet, satellite, 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about baseball as the season officially begins in San Francisco, opening day today over China Basin. And we spoke earlier with Larry Bear, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the San Francisco Giants, who was with us from Pac Bell Park. And Nobody from the A's here, though we tried. We also have Bill Gould with us and Eric Solomon. Both have written a great deal about baseball. Both have made their way through the world of academia. Eric Solomon, English professor at San Francisco State, and Bill Gould, emeritus law professor at Stanford, and both have taught courses in and related to sports and baseball. Bill Gould in sports law and Eric Solomon, history and literature of baseball. We welcome your calls, and if you have something you'd like to say about the upcoming season with respect to the prospects of the A's or the Giants, we'd like to hear from you. If you have something to say about opening day and what it means to you or yours, we'd also be interested in hearing from you. But we're also kind of taking your thoughts about steroids and all of related topics, the mystique of the game, the excitement of the game, the general sense of the love of the game. Here's an email from a listener named Dave who says, Mr. Bear's team seems to actively be planning against the championship. Would it be better to lose with young prospects and build for the future rather than lose with high-paid geezers? Eric Solomon, you're talking about how you love the fact that you have these older players.
Well, high-paid geezers are better than low-paid geezers. They're not, at least, on welfare. Many of the other teams have gone in obviously the opposite direction, and there are a lot of teams that have a great many young players. It is interesting that the force of evil in most of my youth, since I grew up in Boston, the Yankees have a very, very old team too, and everything is old about them. The amount of drug taking that was done by some of them in the past, the enmities that were made between their two best infielders, which goes back into the past, and so on. And that's kind of nice. It's like Romeo and Juliet. Nobody forgives.
Well, speaking about Yankees, what do you think Mike Piazza is going to do in terms of making a difference as designated hitter for Oakland?
That's an open question. He's never really been through what the designated hitter has to go through. In other words, sitting, observing, not able to take his mind off of the hitting because he's not fielding. And if he can make that adjustment the way Thomas obviously did for them last year, he's a big help. He's a good hitter. He's not a great home run hitter, but he's a very good hitter.
We're going to go to your calls. And by the way, again, if you'd like to join us, it's toll-free 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, forum@kqed.org. Before I do, though, Bill Gould, you were saying off mic that there's a kind of increased interest in the game that could be stimulated, that could be inspired, really, by having players represent their own countries. What do you mean?
Well, I think that the World Baseball Classic, which took place last year, which saw these really first-rate players, impeccable play by teams from Japan, Korea, Dominican Republic, and Cuba. I can't help but think that this won't be good for the game. Now, we see more foreign players in the game today, and now the Far East is beginning to have more representation with, as well as Latin America. It may be that China will be a part of this in the future. The Yankees are already sending people over there to look at possible talent. One of the concerns with the advent of foreign players is what happens to baseball in their own countries. In Japan, they're very concerned about the impact that everybody who's watching Matsuzaka with the Boston Red Sox and other outstanding Japanese players, will they come to the ballpark? There's declining attendance in Japan. And I think in many ways, the World Baseball Classic or something akin to it, a real World Cup international competition perhaps can balance this out and to promote national pride on the part of the respective countries supporting their very good players who are coming in such large numbers to the United States.
We've got a caller actually right on point here. Jeff, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, you stole a little bit of my thunder there. I was going to ask your guests to comment a bit on the World Baseball Classic. I was really captivated by the mystique of that whole event, and really see it as a kind of a key part of the future of the game, especially in terms of drawing young people's attention. You know, certainly with the attention span of younger people these days, baseball just doesn't have the offensive kick that the basketball game or football has. And in terms of, you know, baseball existing in competition with those other major sports in the United States in terms of fan bases and attention, it has to look for ways that it can be compelling to people. And I think the World Baseball Classic and having, you know, people playing for their nations and the compelling stories of watching the Cubans topple the mighty Dominicans, it was just absolutely fantastic.
Well, we thank you for the call. I think you're sort of in agreement with Bill Gould on that. And Bill Gould, something else that you said as an African-American that I was a little puzzled by, the notion that the game is too slow for African-Americans. Where does that notion come from?
Are you referring that question to me?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that that's the case necessarily, that the game is too slow.
No, but I never even heard that described to African-Americans. Where does it...
Well, I think that...
Where is it written, so to speak?
I think that the... that African-American... One of the great concerns that I have with the game today is the... Particularly on the 60th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's advent to Major League Baseball, is the dwindling number of African-American players in baseball. And I think that there are a number of factors that are responsible for that. One is the lack of equipment and facilities in inner cities. When I was in Washington in government in the Clinton administration, I looked around for a batting cage. There wasn't one single batting cage in the entire city of Washington, which is predominantly black. The other thing is, Michael, that I think that the colleges have, particularly over these past 30 years, begun to at least partially supplant the lower levels of the minor leagues as a farm system for the major leagues. Minority youth, black youth, are not going into college baseball as they are going into football and basketball. There have been many years where I've watched the Stanford team where there's not been one single black player on the entire team. And why is that? I think a principal reason for that is that the colleges are able to offer full scholarships to kids who are coming out of the inner city in football and basketball, and they don't have full scholarships in baseball. So that the kid who plays, who comes from the inner city in a major city, who plays all these sports, if he's interested in baseball, says, well, look, I can get a free ride if I go to Stanford and play football or basketball, can't do it in baseball. So I think that that is part of the reason we have a dwindling number of black American players, and I'm very concerned about this. I think Major League Baseball has, with the program in Compton, begun to try to address this, but much more needs to be done.
Eric Solomon, let's have you weigh in here.
Well, it's not so much the speed or slowness of the game, and baseball is a contemplative game compared to the spurts of energy in basketball and football. But it is a very hard game to play and to learn how to play properly. And I'm not down to put down basketball or football, but there are positions where people can, at 17, if they are huge enough, immediately gain huge success and huge contracts.
Yeah, but I've heard sports writers say that the least educated are in the major leagues in terms of the sports that we're talking about. And often, you know, you take kids right out of the farm, bonus babies, whatever, you put them into baseball, either in the farm leagues or in when they get into the majors and so forth. And it's not really as challenging in many ways.
They usually...
they don't have to get a college degree.
Neither do the players who go to college and play professional football or basketball at college. No, I think that to learn how to field a position properly, most of the players are kept in the minors till they're 23 or 24. There are some phenomenal pitchers who come up very, very young, always have been. And then eventually they learn to field their position and to think a little while throwing or despite throwing. But I do think that history has proven it is a challenging game to learn. And the numbers who have played well in their early 20s, particularly in the field, are very small. And I think the numbers of football and particularly linemen and basketball players who can be wondrously effective very, very young, it makes the difference. Yeah, the poorer you are, often the greater you are in a hurry to get hold of the big money.
We're getting word here that there are some black players in the current Stanford baseball team, just for the record, Bill Gould. And I want to get some more calls on here. Patrick, on the first day, opening day, good morning.
Good morning. Just want to say and tell you how I feel about the first day of baseball. One word describes it, traffic. Just want to take that offline. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the call. What about the traffic on these opening days, or for that matter, as the season unfolds? Eric Solomon, some thoughts?
The traffic in drugs, are you referring to? Well, if you have to drive by the ballpark when they are having a game, I think you've always run into traffic. If people drive less carefully because they're listening to a ball game while driving, well, it means that they're not doing something else with their ears that is more proactive. So I'm not sure what traffic problem is caused if you stay away from the ballpark.
Well, here's Tulio, who sends an email to us. Terrible traffic and parking problems in my neighborhood, south of Market. Yeah. There you go. Here's another.
Tell him to move to the marina. It'll be easier. Get money somewhere.
Another listener who signs himself Bleacher and says, "Hi, Michael, thanks for the show. I must disagree with one of your distinguished guests. Of course steroids matter. There is no record in sport more hallowed than the baseball career home run record. 755 is a number etched in the consciousness of the American sports fan in a way that NFL and NBA scoring records simply are not. As a tainted Barry Bonds approaches the home run record for many of us, this is a time of sadness rather than celebration. Let's hope that the videos of Bonds' record-breaking home run records a stadium full of the opponents booing fans for all posterity to see. Of course, this is a fantasy because a non-contending Giants team will make sure the record is broken in front of the home friendlies." And here's Craig from Redwood City, who says, "Could you please ask your guests, since there's such a demand for the various performance-enhancing drugs in baseball, and the inventors of new drugs are always going to be one set ahead of the testing, why not legalize them?" Well, we've done shows on that, and we've had, you know, strong debates, both pro and con. Bill Gould, let's hear from you, though. Why not legalize them?
Well, I think that there are two principal reasons for, one principal reason for not legalizing them, and that is the public health problem. I think that is the overriding concern. If you legalize them, you would eliminate the other concern, and that is you don't have a level playing field. Some players have it, some people don't. But I think that clearly there is a public health concern. We had Dick Pound of the World Anti-Doping Agency at the Stanford Law School yesterday, who was talking about the number of bicyclists who have had heart attacks as the result of, in his opinion, the drugs that they have taken. I think that this is a very serious matter. And of course, it's very serious in terms of the example that it provides for youth, because we're looking at the top players in the professional sports, but you know, this is at the top of the pyramid, and all you have all these kids who down the ladder who are trying to emulate them, and I think that this is a very serious public health problem.
And let me remind those of you listening, if you'd like to join us in this discussion about baseball on San Francisco Giants opening day, feel free, toll free, to join us at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. Ken, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to bring the conversation to a different level about drug use. I'm interested in defining it as cheating and asking the question of your guests, What does that mean, that there seems to be such willingness to allow that to continue in this sport? Thanks.
Eric, yeah, so, thank you. Eric Solomon.
Well, you have a problem with baseball, and I think you have a problem with most endeavors, whether they're political or scientific. People do cheat. And baseball, from the beginning, when people were using sandpaper to doctor the ball or grease or various kinds of
saliva
of bats, and of course the spitball and so on. Cheating is part of getting an edge. It's a part of the accepted game. Yes, a base runner cheats if he leans toward second, maybe gets an extra step and gets an advantage. Yes, pitcher will do well if he can outthink the batter, which is in a form not just pure grace and strength. So it's a problem when cheating goes over the line. But to say that in a game that counts on judgment, an umpire's judgment, and so on, it becomes difficult. The problem with baseball is it had the great cheat in the Black Sox scandal, where a World Series actually was thrown.
1919. Rick from San Jose, join us. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a comment about opening day and one comment about the steroid issue. I'm heading to the Giants game today, and I'm a season ticket holder to both the A's and the Giants, so I'll be there at Oakland next Monday. I grew up in Baltimore with the great Earl Weaver teams of the Orioles, and it's just a special day. Very quickly on the steroid issue, I was really upset and dismayed as to how Bud Selig approached the issue with the Mitchell investigation, because I don't think he really thought through what he'd do with that information that's gathered from that investigation. There's no way he's going to be able to identify everyone that was involved in steroids. So therefore, how do you selectively either suspend people or negate records? I just think it makes me wonder how Bart Giamatti might have handled a similar situation. And that's it.
Okay, let's hear from Bill Gould.
Well, I don't think that there is a way that we're ever going to be able to sort out things, so to speak, and to put asterisks by particular records. I think that what we have to say is that there certainly is a cloud over much of what has been accomplished, particularly offensively, but also in terms of some pitchers as well in the 1990s. I think that the Mitchell investigation only will have strength to the extent that Congress threatens to take action, as it has in the past. That's the only way that Mitchell is going to be able to convince the commissioner to get people to talk, as the price of being employed in baseball. Right now, he's not getting apparently very much cooperation at all. Congress is focused upon other things right now. When Congress comes back to this subject, as I'm sure they will at some point, it may be the ingredient that gets things moving again.
You know, I was thinking about all this discussion about steroids. I guess yesterday Giambi did well in the Yankees opening game, and to some extent that's the redemption, it seems. I mean, there are fans who have been concerned perhaps about Barry Bonds or other players, but if the players produce and if the players perform where the fans are concerned, that seems to override, doesn't it, Eric Solomon?
Well, I think I've said this before, but I think logicians have a great deal of trouble when it comes to talking. Are records spoiled because of people taking other forms of injection or therapies into their bodies that make them or allow them to do better? The actual fact is that there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures from the turn of the century through the 20s and 30s that, had they had the availability of, let us say, the Tommy John operation, intrusion and moving of veins in a body, would have had another 6 or 7 or 8 years and not quit, as many pictures did. 32, 33 was the end of the road, and now we have pictures going to 42 and 43. And so records are made to be broken.
It has a lot to do with relief pitching, too, and the fact that relief pitchers can come in, doesn't it?
It has to do with a lot of things. No, not relief pitching. So much hasn't helped players get 300 wins because they don't pitch as long and they don't.
Well, yeah, but I'm just thinking about the fact that it's almost standard now for a pitcher not to go.
Right. Right. There is that. And the equipment has changed. We all know that change is the name of much sport. The really interesting question, which for baseball scholars or sports scholars, would be to find just how many drugs and what kind of drugs and what kind of performance enhancing techniques were done, instead of just rumor and talk and so on in the 20s and 30s and so on. Who took what when?
Well, Bill Gould, you're doing a book about how the game has changed since the Second World War. From your perspective, I mean, we've touched upon a number of things, but it's more competitive now than it's ever been, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly more competitive now in some respects. Now, of course, what has happened is that baseball since 1995 has introduced a new level, a new layer of playoffs. So that more teams can be in the mix. The Yankees, for the past 12 years, always make the playoffs. But for the past 6 or 7 years, they've been unable to progress very far. And you've had a new World Championship winner every year now since, goodness, since 2002. For about 5 years in a row now, we've had complete turnover, and that's led to a great deal of excitement. And I think part of this has also been the fact that even prior to some of the reforms in the collective bargaining agreement between the players and the owners, which I think have been really a subsidiary factor in making the game more competitive, you had the examples of the A's, the Minnesota Twins, the Montreal Expos when they were there before moving to Washington, the small market teams who somehow, with very little money, with the Florida Marlins have been good examples of this. A $15 million payroll compared to $190 million of the Yankees, somehow have been able to come up with very good players through considerable acumen and to be very competitive. So I don't think that we've seen a team, seen an era. Bud Selig calls this the golden era, and I think he's right, where, in the sense that I don't think we've seen an era where there's been more competition, more excitement, more turnover in terms of winners.
And we go to more calls. Bill, thanks for waiting again on opening day. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi. Opening day in baseball is cool, but it makes me think of the first day of practice at Le Mans. It's a new year. It's time to go. People show up with all kinds of crazy ideas, and we'll see what works out. And we know it's a long slog ahead of us. And there's a metaphor for industrialized civilization in baseball, just as there is in any sport that emphasizes showing up and delivering over and over and over, rather than what I would call a marquee sport like football. But the other comment I'd like to make is that in terms of the performance-enhancing drugs and surgery and all the rest of that, it's not a level playing field. People are born unequal, and those who don't feel they're at the top and want to be at the top will do everything that they ever can think of to get to the top, and we say some of it is fair if they're in the weight room, and we say some of it is foul if they're sticking a needle in their arm, and there's good reasons to do that, and the best reason to not throw it open and say, go ahead, take anything you want, is that it produces boring, uninteresting sport. if you look at anything where it's unlimited, where anybody can do anything, you know, in hindsight, people look back, they buy the coffee table books, but the gate receipts for any kind of unlimited sport are always very low. It's not a living for the players if it's an unlimited sport.
So Bill, appreciate your comments. Thank you for that. We'll let them stand, and we'll try to get more of your calls on here, time remaining. Natalie, good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning, Michael.
Hi.
I would hope that the Giants management would announce a moment of silence before every ball game to honor our military men and women and the National Guard who are fighting in Iraq. There is just too much fun and games while this terrible war goes on.
Well, thank you for that comment, and I appreciate hearing from you, hearing from a lot of people via email. Here's a listener who says, baseball is taught by fathers. Most of us fans learned it by watching games with Dad and playing catch with Dad. The foundation of Little League ball is fathers who coach after work. Given the shocking percentage of black boys without fathers in their homes, it's no surprise they don't embrace the game. Some thoughts, Bill Gould?
Well, I don't really have I don't really subscribe to that idea. I think that if I look at my own experience, I played baseball day and all day, every day. My mother made sandwiches for me, and the other kids that I played with, their mothers made sandwiches for them, and we did nothing but talk about baseball, play baseball. As it happens, my father, who was more interested in me than any man in this world, had no interest in baseball whatsoever. And I think that that the father-son business is important. I like to think that I played a role in making my sons interested, probably too interested in baseball, but I think that this is exaggerated a bit. Look, black kids in inner cities have many problems, and part of those problems are attributable to a disproportionate number of broken families.
But you know, this is a whole other program. We're at the end of the hour.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
let's save it for the mothers a little. They help kids become ball players.
Well said. Yeah, and indeed, and the coaches and the phys ed teachers and so forth. Thank you both. Thanks to Eric Solomon and Bill Gould. Thanks also to Larry Bear. And thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G, and Kevin Guillory. Executive producer for him is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.